Welcome to Board Game Binge, the place where we bring you bite-sized, bingeable board game content from across the industry. I'm your host, James Staley, and in this episode, we're chatting with Jamie Stegmaier, founder of Stohlmeyer Games, designer of Viticulture, Euphoria, Scythe, Charterstone, and Tapestry. He's also a published author. His 8 crowdfunding campaigns have raised over $3.2 million, and he shares his insights, mistakes, and lessons learned on his weekly podcast and blog. Jamie, welcome to the binge. How are you?
Thank you so much for having me. Yeah, I'm excited to join you today.
Oh, thanks for coming on. I really do appreciate it. Yeah. And I wanted to throw kind of the published author in there because I do have your book.
Oh, cool.
Crowdfunder Strategy Guide.
Nice.
And I just want to say off the hop, anybody watching, anybody listening, if you have yet to do a Kickstarter campaign, or maybe you have done one, a small one, and you're looking to kind of take it to the next level, you got to read this book. I mean, I know that on your website, you go through very liberally all your learnings and you're very transparent on what you've learned every step along the way. But this book I found was really good at kind of encapsulating kind of the whole process from start to end. And I know for myself, having run Kickstarter campaigns, I still was learning stuff reading this book. So a great read. Definitely well written too. And I know in reading the book, you talk a little bit about fiction. I guess you've done some fiction work in the past, right?
Just for fun. Yeah. Just as a hobby. Yeah. I'm not, I have a few published short stories, but no published novels or anything like that yet.
Well, it certainly comes through in the writing. I mean, it's an easy read. It's very story-based as you go through with lots of examples, and it was just awesome. Lots of meat on the bone. I think that's a great segue kind of into the first thing I want to get into is you published this in 2015. And I believe 2015 is when your last Kickstarter campaign was, you know, before you guys went and started kind of doing your publishing direct. Reflecting back on that, is there anything now kind of looking at the industry, which is rapidly evolving, and 5 years is an immense amount of time in the technology world.
Yeah.
Is there anything where you look back and you say, gosh, you know, now through today's lens, I think I would state that differently, or maybe that lesson should be positioned a different way, or maybe it's not even relevant.
Yeah, that's a great question. And every now and then I go back and look at the book to see, is this still relevant? Do I need to make a revised version? Do I need to add to certain chapters, things like that?
Yeah.
And I am continually surprised by how the core principles in the book still apply today.
Yeah.
A lot of them are not even very specific about, like, you know, structure your rewards exactly like this, this, and this. There are some things like that in the book, but a lot of it's core principles, like put your backers first. If you put your backers first, a lot of good things can happen, can emerge from that. So those core principles, I think, are largely the same. There may be little things that have changed over time. Like, I think the $1 reward level, which I'm pretty sure I advocate that in the book.
Yeah.
I don't think that's quite as important now. Because Kickstarter has changed the structure, the format of their reward sidebar.
But sure.
Overall, yeah, I think it's anything that you noticed that jumped out that you were like, maybe this isn't as true today in 2020 as it was in 2015.
Hey, this is your interview, not my interview, man. No, you know what? I thought what I really honed in on, quite frankly, was the Amazon fulfillment.
I have
in my own personal business, which is not game related, but we do have Amazon stores in you know, 3 different countries. Mm-hmm. And my most recent campaign I did, which is a small one, and for people listening to the podcast know that I did a card game kind of in honor to my 102-year-old grandmother. And so the number of backers we had wasn't massive. We shipped out about 250 games. Most of those were in Canada, and in the States. But shipping from Canada, I found that you lose tracking abilities as soon as you cross the border. Knowing, having read this after my fulfillment, retrospect, I wish I could have reversed time because I probably would have put this through my Fulfilled by Amazon and I would have had that tracking capability. So I thought that was pretty interesting. But no, I think you're right. The you know, it's about the backer, it's about the audience, it's about building that following, right? And you know, I think a lot of trap that especially new Kickstarters get into is they kind of see these big numbers, right? And they'll say, oh, it's a simple card game. They did $500,000. Well, wow, you know, I should be able to do, you know, even 25% of that, you know, with my campaign, not understanding that maybe some of these were coming from you know, IP that's already out there. So maybe there's a YouTube channel that has, you know, 1.2 million followers, or maybe it's a comic book that's been going for 10 years and they're able to draw on those fans and pull them over to the Kickstarter campaign. So yeah, it might be the first Kickstarter campaign, but it's not kind of the first kick at talking to their consumer, right? So for me, that's what I thought was kind of relevant, but certainly earmarked a lot as I went through. And again, for people who have not necessarily launched a Kickstarter or maybe looking to do it, I found it was a good read. Another thing I know that you really do well, and I haven't got through them all, but on your StillmeyerGames.com website, I'll share my screen here for the people who are actually watching live. For the people listening, I encourage you to go to StillmeyerGames.com. But it is just riddled with information for publishers or for developers or designers or anybody that's looking to kind of get into this industry. Like Jamie just breaks down every possible lesson you can think of using real world examples of things you've gone through. I mean, we interviewed Travis Jones on here a few weeks back on Pendulum, right? Uh-huh. And, you know, and I've also seen on your page here, you know, lessons learned, Pendulum. Here's 4 publishing insights about Pendulum. And this just launched. So I think it's pretty cool that you certainly give back to the community and you certainly have a focus on, you know, trying to help others. And, you know, I hear this time and time again that in this industry, it's probably the only industry I know where competitors are trying to help competitors, where people are trying to, who know that, you know, this person is competing with me in the marketplace, but they don't view it that way. They view it as, hey, you know, if I can give, I'm going to get, right? The more I can put out there, the more it's going to come back. And so I think you've kind of been one of the trailblazers in that regard. And I want to thank you for that. I think that's awesome. What are some of the things you think about when you write these blogs and you do your weekly podcast? What's kind of your core thought going in?
Well, part of it is actually what you just said. I have a lot of random topics that I like to write about, but whenever I'm deciding which topic I'm going to write about, I do 2 blog posts a week. I always try to ask, is this going to add value to anyone other than myself? Because I do gain value myself by writing these entries. Sometimes I poll people, so I'm getting data that I can use for my company. Sometimes I'm just processing an idea or a thought or a mistake that I made. I'm putting it in writing and processing it. So that's helpful for me. But I'm still trying to focus on, is there some takeaway that other creators can benefit from here? And that has really helped. Keeping that frame of reference, I think, has helped the blog itself and helped the engagement for the blog and help people participate in it or read it and share it. But it's also helped just the overall philosophy of Stillmeyer Games in terms of being audience focused instead of internally focused on what we want to do. We're trying to focus on how we can bring joy to tabletops worldwide.
As one thing I noticed that, you know, there's a lot of your personality that you put into these, for lack of a better word, and, you know, transparency, like this is who I am. Right. And you even talk about that in your book on, you know, your conscious decision to move from putting like a logo on your blogs and move to an actual photo, right? Here's a photo of me in my living room or a photo of me at my desk. And just brings kind of more of that personal touch to some of the stuff that when you're interacting with your fans, which I think is pretty cool. Now, in 2015, you made a pretty big decision. I mean, there's companies out there right now that are what I would classify as successful game companies. Mm-hmm. That are still using the Kickstarter platform, right? So you guys made a decision, we're going to move away from that. So I know that it's covered in some of your blogs, but maybe you can talk a little bit about that decision, why you made that decision, other than being just financially stable at the time. Why?
Yeah, and it just to clarify the timing there a little bit, because I think it is relevant to the answer. In 2015, the Scythe Kickstarter ended. It did very well on Kickstarter. I think it was around 1.8 million on Kickstarter. I didn't make the decision then to not go back to Kickstarter, because then it was exciting, it was awesome. Okay. You know, I could have kept on going. It was that summer after the fulfillment of Scythe, which was fulfilled early. It was reviewed very well, received very well by backers. Pretty much everything went well on the game.
Yeah.
And yet it was kind of a dark summer for me and for Stillmeyer Games, because there was just a flood of it was weird. It was like, you know, we're fulfilling this game early and we're still getting tons of complaints from people about, hey, why I heard that someone in New York got their copy of the game. I'm in California. Why haven't I gotten my copy of the game? And it wasn't just like a few people. It was hundreds of people talking about this. That was one factor. There were just other things like that added up, including one fulfillment center in Europe who completely dropped the ball and made me realize just how close we came to losing potentially hundreds of thousands of dollars, because a company that I had trusted and sent a ton of product to barely wrapped these games at all when they shipped them to people throughout Europe.
Oh man.
So I had this experience with customers who were very excited about the game and were expressing their passion in kind of a weird way. And with a company that had we were putting a lot of trust in this company, it didn't work out. And it could have been any company. That company had done great things for us in the past. And after all that, we kind of just processed what it meant for us to go through that process with Kickstarter. And the whole, I think the psychology created in terms of anticipation when you put something on Kickstarter and then you wait, you put people through this process of waiting for 6 or 8 months or a year before they get something. There's a weird element of human psychology that can happen when people get really excited about something and just act in different ways. And we just decided we wanted to move away from that. And rather than putting people through that process, we wanted to just make stuff that we really believed in and then tell people about it and start shipping it within a few weeks. That's evolved over time, but that was the core idea that we wanted to give it a try. Mm-hmm. And since then, we haven't had to return to Kickstarter. We haven't used it ever since.
Is there any things that you find? So obviously, you have the benefit of faster turnaround for your people who are looking for your games, and you've got the company obviously has a big following now. Is there anything that you've kind of missed from the Kickstarter side where you look back and say, God, I just wish I had that one kind of piece?
I mean, Kickstarters are still really exciting. I still back a lot of Kickstarters, and every now and then I get swept away in the excitement of another campaign. But I miss that excitement. I miss how the amount of energy and the amount of shared creative energy and passion that goes into those 3 to 4 weeks of a campaign.
Yeah.
And that, as much as I've tried to capture that post Kickstarter, it doesn't compare. I mean, people are still excited about our products when we announce something new, and that's awesome. But it's a different type of excitement for people to experience and for me to experience as a creator. Yes, I missed that.
Yeah, I think certainly the time factor has got to be a frustration for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. The ability, though, to as a publisher, be able to focus group your game. Essentially, that's what Kickstarter is. It's supposed to be is like a focus group for your game. Is this something that people want? Demonstrate they want it by backing and by pledging, right? And there's some interaction back and forth so they can have a bit of a mark on how that game is finalized, right? So if there's certain things you want to do, they can input in that. How have you emulated that now on your side? The whole focus group and the whole kind of getting people's feedback, what's the process you guys have built now to kind of replicate that on your side?
Yeah, there are two different sides of that I see great value in. One is getting the feedback and improving the product itself. And we do that through pretty much hundreds of blind playtesters that we have. That whenever we're working on a game, I send it out in many waves, usually between 3 and 5 waves of blind playtesting, where I send out digital files of the game, of the prototype of the game, to playtesters that I've kind of vetted and that I trust, who play it with their groups locally and send me anecdotal feedback and data so I can better balance the game, make it more fun, make it more intuitive. I do this for all of our products. So that's the focus group side. On the other side is the gauging demand for it. How many copies should we make for that first print run so we can meet demand? That's a little bit more difficult. I definitely miss that about Kickstarter. And so we now have a different focus group now of distributors and retailers, where we go to them in advance before production begins and we say, here's this game that we're going to make. It's a secret right now. You can't talk about it, but we would love to get your feedback about how well you think this is going to do on the market. It's a guessing game for anyone to do that. It's even a guessing game on Kickstarter. I mean, you know how many backers want it, but you don't know how it will go into retail and distribution after that. So it's still a guessing game. But we've gotten some great data from doing that and some great early commitments for orders from distributors and retailers many, many months in advance too, that have helped reduce the risk of us making a big print run of a new expansion or a new game.
I was going to say that, as part of that process, is there a encouraging these retailers to almost do pre-bookings to say, look, you want to make sure you got inventory. We need a pre-book from you. Otherwise, I'm going to have to give it to somebody else who does commit up front. And, you don't want to be that store that everybody's coming and ask for the game and you don't have a copy. Right. So that's part of your process. And I guess to lock down some of these pre-orders with the retailers.
We have evolved into that, over the last, because there was a thing that happened with Wingspan where we didn't make nearly enough copies of Wingspan for the first print run. And so over the last year and a half, I've been moving towards what you just said, and that's what we just started doing very recently. Not for a lot of retailers, but for a small group of retailers and for the core distributors that we sell to.
Is there any kind of like market testing you do? Like, is it mainly kind of qualitative or is there any kind of quantitative testing you do, like any kind of price elasticity tests or anything like that to see if, you know, do we have the price right? What kind of demand, how will the demand be affected if, you know, the price goes up by another $5 or so forth? Is that part of your process yet?
In a way, but it's a lot of going by my instinct and my understanding of the market.
Experience too, yeah.
Yeah, so yeah, I definitely try to, I follow a lot of different games and publishers and how various games are doing. And so like with Pendulum, I had a price point that I wanted for Pendulum and I didn't want to go above that. I knew it was a real-time game with timers that can turn people off. And so I didn't, even though we could have, probably should have sold the game for around $70, I wanted to get it down to 60. So I kind of made some decisions to push it down to a $60 MSRP, things like that, where I definitely have changed components or changed the price based on what I think we need to sell it for.
Yeah, it's a pretty beefy game, Pendulum. We're going through it with Travis. I was like, holy smokes, this seems underpriced. So, and that's the challenge, I think, too, right? Is like, how do you figure out how much goes in that box? Because I know quality is very important to you and, you know, making sure you get the best possible components and the best possible experience for the fans of Stonemaier Games. But at some point, you are going to hit a price threshold where people are going to say, maybe not. Maybe I'll wait till somebody, one of my friends is tired of it and I'll buy it off of them and so forth. So it's kind of gauging that. And I guess the scary part is probably the risk, right? Of now you don't have those, the Kickstarter kind of get all the orders, then go make it based on your orders. And then, you know, talk to retailers, find out how much extended inventory you need. Now you're in a situation where you're having to forecast and you better hope your forecast is right. Because when you're getting into truckloads or you're getting into skids upon skids of games, that's a lot of money that is at risk, right? Especially if it doesn't pan out. And I know that, you know, a lot of publishers maybe not even think about, well, what if your game is going to take a year to sell through that inventory? Are you thinking about the storage costs, you know, because all these are components of the mix, right? Is it you have to pay a facility to hold your games, right? And you're looking at $20, $25 a skid to hold the games, depending on how many different warehouses all around the world, right? Mm-hmm. So the numbers start adding up very quickly. And it's easy to kind of fall into that trap of, you know, especially for new developers, hey, you know, this manufacturer is promising to get my price down by like $8 if I order, you know, 5,000 versus 1,000. Wow, that'll give me extra copies and I can sell those at retail. Yeah, you can, but you have to think of the math between when those, that last unit sold and when you're getting your inventory of, you know, if you work that math into the whole mix, right?
Yeah. Oh yeah. I'm glad you said that, because I think a lot of people don't think about that. The storage fees in particular, they can really, really add up if you're not selling the games. It's one thing, you've spent money to make those games and you're not actually earning that money back on selling them, and you're paying those storage costs. We've had that happen with games and expansions that I made too many of. I would still rather make too few, because I can always make more than sell, than make too many and have them sitting in the warehouse for a couple of years.
And certainly I think there's a bit of a viral aspect to that too, right? If someone sees a game that everybody's talking about and nobody can get it, it's kind of like COVID and toilet paper, right? It's like, oh my God, you know, all the stores are sold out of toilet paper. So what does everybody do? Rush to get more toilet paper and stock up, right? So certainly not to use toilet paper in games as an analogy, but it's the most timely example I can give. So what do you do when you have the example you gave of this European company that didn't pack your game well? You know, I can just imagine how those games are arrived. I know a lot of, especially Kickstarter backers, but I'm sure just game collectors in general, if there's even a scuff on the box, it's like, oh, am I going to get a replacement or am I going to get a refund? How did you deal with that? Because I imagine it was just a disaster, like this showing up at some of these locations if it's not packed properly, right?
I look back on it almost as a small miracle, because I saw photo after photo of how these games were packaged by this company. And it bewilders me. I don't know what they were thinking. They went out of business soon afterwards because they were packing games like this. And we were shipping, I mean, these were Scythe collector's editions that people had paid over $100 for. And we just got lucky. I mean, pure luck that the vast majority of these games arrived with very little damage. I don't know how. But it also ties back, I think, to what you said about Amazon. Amazon can be good to work with, but I wouldn't ever use Amazon fulfillment for a collector's edition style game, a game where if you get a dented corner you have to replace that at a rather large expense, because Amazon, their goal is to get the product to you and they expect you to have it packaged in such a way so that it can't be damaged. So there are other fulfillment centers that have sprung up in the gaming industry in particular to deliver games in ways that are pristine, that the corners are perfect and whatnot.
It certainly is like the pet detective, right? When he's, you know, kicking the package all the way down the hall to get to the, and you get it. And everybody's received packages like that from Amazon, where you're like, what the heck happened here? Like, they play football with this package. I've got a bunch of people in the lobby, watching the interview. One question that came in from Mike Bruner. He said, most game designers going the Kickstarter route are trying to spread the word everywhere they can. And you seem to keep things much more quiet, and then you go public when your game information is kind of on a very specific timeline and a kind of a very specific pace. Yeah. Is that something you recommend to other designers, or is this just something that works for you guys?
I think for new designers, I think it's very important to talk about the game early and often and everywhere. Yeah. Not in a pushy way, but just put it out there. Don't try to hide it. Don't try to protect it. Just share it. Get it out there. Get people talking about it if they want to talk about it. I think my company is at a very different place at this point than the new designer. But if for maybe a more established company, if it's your fourth game, your fifth game, I think the psychology of anticipation comes into play there. Where if you announce something really, really early, like we do with Scythe, I announced Scythe and Charterstone probably too early. And I saw the anticipation go in waves. The word hype was used a lot, even though I basically just like shared an image of Scythe. I wasn't saying it was the best thing ever. I was just like, here's the box art. Yeah. And then over the next 8 months, I got to experience what it looked like to see a lot of people talk about something that I wasn't sharing much more about during that time. And Charterstone took longer to make than I thought. And I was talking about it fairly early with a rough timeline. And then it took much longer than I thought to actually get out there in the world. So for more established companies, I think it's good to remove some of those uncertainties before you start talking about it.
Got it. And with your next game, where are you going from here? So I know that you've kind of stated, you know, on your blog and so forth, that your goal is to do two games a year, I believe is what your goal was, right?
Right.
The Pendulum this year, which I think is the only title technically in 2020. Yeah. What's next on the horizon? What's the next game coming? When is it coming? When can people expect the next Magic from Stonemaier Games?
Well, the next Magic will be the Wingspan Oceania expansion based in Australia and New Zealand. It's not a new game, but that is the next product. That'll be in a couple months here in 2020 to end 2020. And then in 2021, we have two games planned. One, I could talk about it yet. I'm not going to talk about it yet. I'm really excited about it. This is one that's been in the works for a long, long time. The other one is a game called Rolling Realms. I can talk about that because I've announced that we are going to make a printed version of this. This was a game that I made as a print and play at the beginning of the pandemic, hoping that the pandemic would figure it out. It would go away after a few months. Obviously, that didn't happen. It was a game that I designed to be played virtually. It's a infinitely scaling roll and write game.
Oh, cool.
But it ended up catching on and doing pretty well, and people seem to have fun with it. So I'm making a fancy printed version of that to release next year.
And the other, so the first game that you cannot talk about, is it a game you guys have created, or is this another developer's game that you've kind of signed up?
Yeah, right now we're about balanced half and half. You mentioned the five games that I've designed. We published five games from other designers.
Yep.
This one is actually a little in between. It's the first new game that I've designed with a co-designer, a full co-designer. I know Alan's name is on the box of a few of the first games, but he was really more of a lead playtester. And so this is one full collaboration with me and another designer that I'm excited about.
So when you have, really, if you're doing half and half, that means every two games a year, there's going to be one game that's going to be from another developer, and next year
usually.
Usually the model.
Yeah.
How do you find that one game? What's your process to find the game, right? Because that's a big deal than to have just one from someone else per year.
Yeah. It depends on the circumstances. The typical way is that we have a submission form on our website where anyone can go on and look at the guidelines, look at what we're looking for in a game. Yeah. And if their game fits those guidelines, they can submit it to us and we take a look at it. I believe Elizabeth for Wingspan originally filled out that form. That's how we discovered it. But our other games kind of have different stories there. Like Pendulum was at, we host a Design Day event here in St. Louis. That's kind of like a proto spiel or an unpub event where people come and play test their games. That's where Pendulum first appeared and we saw it there. Between Two Cities was something that happened at Gen Con. I was talking with the designer at Gen Con and he had Ben Rossett and Matthew O'Malley had a game that they showed to me. And I've ended up working with them in the future too, because I really enjoyed working with them the first time.
Sure.
As with any of our designers, I would gladly work with Travis again. I would gladly work with Elizabeth again, or Hobie, who did My Little Scythe. Yeah. So part of it's, you know, creating those relationships and continuing them, because I know that I like working with these people.
Oh, awesome. Jamie, that's our half hour. Man, this time goes... Yeah. Way too fast. And I know you're a busy dude, so we won't hold you on the line too much longer, but hey, we'd love to have you come back for like a round two, round three, if possible. Yeah. Every few months we can get you back, and you're just a wealth of knowledge. For anybody that wants to either follow your blog, they would go to stonemeyergames.com. Your podcast, is it published on just on your website, or can they find it on Spotify, Stitcher, and all these as well?
Yeah, the podcast is just a podcast version of some of the game design videos that I do. It's linked on our website as well.
On your website as well. If somebody thinks they've got the next big game and they want to submit it to you, they can submit it on your website again, right? So they can submit it there. Mm-hmm. And if somebody just has a question, I get the impression you're the kind of guy that you actually answer emails. I certainly see you respond to a lot of blogs, and shockingly, I don't know where you get the time, quite frankly. How best do people reach out to you if they have something that they want to try to engage with you?
I'm glad you asked that. The best way by far, if someone has a question, is to post it on like my Facebook live chat or in the comments of my YouTube design channel or my blog, because that way the answer can hopefully benefit more than just that one person. And other people might chime in with different perspectives as well. If it's something that's truly private and confidential, they can email me, but I would say 99% of things are things that can help other people. So they might as well be posted publicly, and I will answer them there.
Well, on behalf of the Board Game Binge, I just want to thank you for all your contribution thus far over these years to the community. Thanks. I know there's much more coming, and it's really cool if you come on the podcast. I really do appreciate it. So all the best to you and your family.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. You take care. Yeah. Cheers.
Cheers.
This has been an episode of the Board Game Binge podcast, hosted by James Staley, produced by James Staley and Mike Bruner, with original music by Nick Smith. If you would like to watch these interviews live, simply join the Facebook group Board Game Binge, and you'll get access to live interviews, giveaways, and interesting board game content from across the industry. I can't wait for you to join us. See you next time.